Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, you're listening to New Books in History. I'm your host, Dexter Fergie. Today I'll be speaking with Asa McKercher about his exciting new book called Canada and the World Since 1867. McKercher is an assistant professor at the Royal Military College of Canada. If you can't tell by the way I pronounce the word about, I should probably let you know that I'm from Canada. And I have to make a confession. Growing up in Vancouver, I was fed the line that Canadian history was dull, that it lacked drama. You know, there was no Revolutionary War against England. And so my historical attention has always been drawn to the United States. It wasn't until I was deep into college that I began to think otherwise. And as a result, I know far too little about my country's history. McKercher's book is a very good rebuttal to the Canadian history is boring thesis. Surveying the history of Canada's relations with the rest of the world, the book tracks how Canada slowly de-dominionized from Britain, how it waged an ugly campaign against First Nations communities to assist settlers westward, and how it dealt with having a superpower for a neighbor. The book should not be read, however, just by Canadians or Canadian historians. In examining the history of a medium-sized state's foreign policy, McKercher's book helps us understand how the international system itself works. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I'm speaking with Asa McKercher about his book, Canada and the World Since 1867. Welcome to the show, Asa.
Well, thanks, Dexter. Thanks for having me. This is wonderful to be here.
Yeah, and I recently wrote my first comprehensive exam, which was on U.S. history. And so your book was really a sight for sore eyes. I was just thrilled to be reading about a different country. And I must confess right now that I'm slightly embarrassed as a Canadian at how much I learned from your book. It was really terrific.
Well, I'm very pleased to have upped your Canadian content, your CanCon.
That's right. Culture. Yeah, we'll be getting into CanCon later in the podcast.
I hope so. Yeah.
Yeah. First, just to start us off, most of the listeners to this podcast are not going to be Canadian. Most are going to be American. And so I really want to, sort of deal with this before we take our listeners on a journey through Canadian history. So I'd love to hear from you why international historians should pay attention to Canadian history.
Sure. I think as we were discussing before we started recording, I started off doing American history. I went to Cambridge to do a PhD in American history and returned to Canada through a hiring of postdoc opportunities, ended up teaching Canadian history at several universities here. And, I think what's interesting about Canadian history and coming at it from an American perspective and a sort of an international history perspective is so many of the themes we see play out in other areas of international history are themes that Canadian history can provide some additional sort of examples of or context of or counters to a different kind of take on something. So we could talk about the influence of sort of the British world kind of history and the sort of the imperial relations, Commonwealth relations, settler colonialism is another big thing. I mean, Canada's obviously overlooked by many Americans, but we've been at northern neighbor for quite a while, and there's a huge interchange between Canadians and Americans, and a whole series of things, from trade and natural resources to ideas and politics and also all kinds of things. And so in the realm of kind of international history, I think there's a lot of things you could point to Canada towards and make connections to other areas of interest. And certainly, I mean, part of this will sound very parochial, but there's a tendency in American history to look, obviously, at American examples as being the primary kind of focus of things, but to overlook Canada. And lonely Canadians sometimes are bleeding, well, what about Canada? But so much of, say, the borderlands, just to take an example, so much of the borderland studies, which is maybe not as popular now as it used to be a few years ago, but there's certainly lots of people doing borderland stuff, often focuses on Mexico and the United States, but there's that whole northern borderland too, where there's a lot of interesting kinds of things going on. So I think that's part of the focus, is Canada's often overlooked, when it really, I think, shouldn't be. And that's like sort of been the focus of my very small scholarly output in terms of things, is to publish in presses that aren't Canadian, so that maybe there's a chance some non-Canadians will read some things about Canada. So this is, for instance, published with Bloomsbury, not a Canadian press at all. So that's just an example of that sort of thing.
Great. And just on a more personal note, what pulled you towards a career in history in the first place?
My father's actually a historian. Although it's one of those things, when I was a boy, I don't know how old I was, 8, let's say, he sat me down and said, "Son, I'll support you in whatever you want to do. If you want to become a lawyer or a plumber, but just don't become an historian." And so, in an act of terrible rebellion, I decided to not take that advice. So, mm-hmm. But also, I was drawn to history, I think, as many people are, wanting to understand the past and perhaps influence on the future. And I don't know if that's quite true, but it's kind of idealistic things maybe you think in high school. But certainly understanding the past, I think, is very, very important. And I worked for a number of years at the Library and Archives Canada, the National Archives in Ottawa. And so I had a passion for history from the kind of the back end, from the archival kind of perspective, but also then from the sort of scholarly perspective as well. So.
And just really quickly, what sort of history did your dad do?
Oh, British political and economic kind of history.
Okay. Okay, great. So now let's move into the book. So Canada was confederated in 1867, but you make it clear that Confederation was not independence. What was it then?
More or less a sort of halfway house, I guess, between independence and colonial dependency. Obviously, the term independence for Canadians, especially in 1867, had a very American flavor, which was not very politically popular in Canada. And so, of course, even in 1926, there's something called the Balfour Declaration. It's kind of a declaration of independence, but the Canadian government was very clear that the word autonomy should be used, because independence, again, sounded very American. And so what happens in 1867 is Canada essentially gets more or less a lot of control over sort of internal issues. In terms of international history, it gets the ability to make trade agreements, but it doesn't have any control over foreign policy legally and under the kind of way Canada set up. And there's still, of course, huge ties, those ties of kith and kin between many Canadians who view themselves as British, perhaps are British, indeed, in terms of immigration and kinds of things. They may be first generation, I think, recent arrivals. Certainly view Canada as part of the British Empire, even though it's become this, and the term they coin is dominion, which is this sort of self-governing dominion, which is able to govern its own affairs, but is still in many ways tied to Britain through a whole series of legal mechanisms, from the Governor General, who's a British, at this time a British lord appointed from London, who can still, in the context of 1867, can still have control over some aspects of Canadian domestic affairs, even, to the lack of, say, even a Supreme Court, the final court of appeal until the 1940s, in fact, is a committee of the House of Lords in London. And of course, this issue of foreign policy, which will really, of course, be important for Canada, because in August 1914, we enter the war, not of our own choice, in effect, but because the King of Canada is the King of England, and he's declared over Britain, and he's declared war against Germany. And so by fiat, we're at war. So that'll obviously be very, very important 50 years after Confederation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was actually really fascinated by just how British Canada was until really late. I mean, this is a little bit earlier, but in 1891, John A. Macdonald's on the campaign trail, and he says, "A British subject I was born, a British subject I will die." And this is apparently a really popular sentiment. And it's so different from, obviously the American case. But this sort of British sensibility or British sense of identity was really, it really persisted until quite late.
Yeah, I mean, even the Diefenbaker government in the 50s and 60s made a big appeal to sort of British sensibilities of Canadians almost 100 years after Confederation. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a remarkable kind of thing. And in terms of, the sort of Canada's first few decades of creation, I mean, this is a period where a majority of immigrants who do come, and there's, several waves of immigration that have a majority people from the British Isles. And this is also a period, as I like to remind my students, the British Empire is in some ways at the height of its power. This is the era of Rudyard Kipling and things. And so this is, why wouldn't you want to be British if you were Canadian? Why wouldn't you want to have this larger sense of identity and be on the winning side, in effect, where the sun never sets? And so, that kind of appeals to Canadians, I think, at this time. For some Canadians, I should say, that it's certainly not many French Canadians and certainly not many so-called ethnic Canadians, I guess would be the term people would use even at the time. Because part of that wave of immigration is people from continental Europe who certainly aren't pro-British necessarily. Although, again, there's some cases where they were to fit into Canadian society. They become sort of flag-waving imperialists, and it's an interesting thing in itself.
Mm-hmm. And so you've already mentioned that Britain retained control of Canada's foreign policy, at Confederation and for several decades after. But you also show that Canada's first major independent foray into international diplomacy was its treaty negotiations with First Nations communities. Can you share with listeners a bit about this and why it's important to read Canadian Indigenous relations as international relations?
Sure. Well, I think by definition, they're international relations. I mean, a treaty is I don't want to get the old, by Webster's dictionary says, but but that's the case, and that a treaty is negotiated and formed between two independent nations. And so, part of, I guess, what the book does is to bring in the history of Crown Indigenous or Canadian Indigenous relations into the history of Canadian foreign policy, which I think is perhaps a controversial thing, and certainly some of the reviewers of my book were not too happy about that. Also because it's not a happy story. But it's important, I think, to address the fact that some of Canada's first acts of diplomatic negotiation weren't in the context of the 1920s or 1930s, when we, the typical kind of thing, but were in fact negotiations in this very dark story of Canadian expansion across the plains. And there's certainly been a lot of attention, as you're no doubt aware, over the past decade, half decade in Canada, growing attention to the situation involving Indigenous people in Canada, which comes and goes in waves. But this certainly the current kind of attention on these issues is, I don't want to say unprecedented, but much bigger than perhaps since maybe the late 1960s. And part of that is it actually involved the work of historians to kind of recreate a lot of the story of Canadian dealings in the 1870s, 1880s. In terms of Indigenous people and the role really of our first Prime Minister, John Macdonald, who in addition to being our first Prime Minister was also for many, many years held two dual portfolios and was also Minister of Indian Affairs and was responsible then in effect for a policy which you could probably fairly term ethnic cleansing, if not something worse, which was the use of food rations essentially to starve Indigenous people out of the way of settlement in violation of some of the agreements made in these treaties. And so if we think of Canada's relationship with Indigenous people as a state-to-state relationship, we get a much darker tale, I think, about Canadian diplomacy than the typical glad-handing middle power sort of relationship that we might think of.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of, I think, what I do in the or try to do in the book, and again, it's a, you know, pretty broad-ranging book, so I had to go into a lot of detail. Was not possible thanks to that old friend of ours, the word count. But was to kind of map out maybe how, you know, other historians might look at these things in depth, because certainly our this relationship between Canada and Indigenous people is something not only in the 1870s and 80s, but I try to show it, you know, in different areas throughout the 150 years that the book covers, how these relationships sort of will affect Canada's relationship at home with Indigenous peoples, and how these, you know, the world that has an impact on sort of settler colonialism is an issue. And so currently, I mean, there's in interior British Columbia, there's a standoff between Indigenous people and the RCMP. And I've just seen some reports at the same time as Canada's, we're campaigning right now for a seat on the UN Security Council, and the Norwegian delegation who we're campaigning against has indicated to, you know, to the press that Norway doesn't have a problem with its Indigenous people like Canada, and so perhaps deserves the seat on Security Council more than Canada. So, mm-hmm. You know, these links between things that happen at home in Canada and the world is always been present, and I think the current examples continue to bear those sorts of things out.
Yeah, I think your book does a really good job in just showing these various connections between what's happening at home and what's happening abroad. And I think the example that you just mentioned is really interesting, because like, not only is Canadian Indigenous relations, a form of international relations, but then like those relations also affect, Canadian international relations, Canadian diplomacy elsewhere. These connections are all moving in different directions.
And so can I just, one thing I've really, come to, and there's this big debates that we've had in Canada and in the wider field for a while, field of history for a while, this kind of debate between political history and sort of social cultural history and the history of, you know, minority groups or something. And there's kind of created as this dichotomy between them. But I think, one thing, our experience with Schaefer, the Society of Historians of American Foreign Relations, has shown is that, in the kind of America in the world field, it's that dichotomy can be broken down, and so you can have a melding of kind of, traditional kind of approaches to history, the Rankean kind of stuff, with new kind of approaches. And so that's happened elsewhere in Canadian history in terms of military history, for instance, is obviously used to be the old, very old fashioned kind of thing. And then the big growth over the past 15 or 20 years in the war and society has really transformed, I think, the teaching and study of military history in Canada. So what I've said, in this book, or tried to do in this book, is to say, this is possibly international historians in Canada, of which I count myself as one, we complain about how we're no one likes us in the history departments in most Canadian universities. But if we, maybe try a bit more to do more broad-reaching history, or put more people in our tent by incorporating people who might, adopt transnational approaches, or something, we're actually maybe not doing so bad if we think, broaden our tent a little bit. And so I've tried to sort of point the way toward doing that, perhaps.
Yeah. This might be this question might elicit an obvious answer, but I'm very curious. Why didn't Canada acquire an overseas empire?
I suppose we took part in some overseas adventures by the British, South Africa, the Boer War, probably most famously, and certainly Canadians found themselves fighting on behalf of the British Empire. So there were a number of graduates of the institution I teach for now, the Royal Military College in Kingston, who Canada had really no military to speak of, even though they created this military college to train officers. And so most of those officers, many of those officers, commissioned into the British Army and went, many of them went on to big careers serving the British Empire. And so even though they weren't Canadian soldiers, they were Canadians who, because of Canada's links through the British world, were able to serve across Africa and Asia and other kinds of things. But in terms of building its own overseas empire, I suppose Canada had enough stuff to do at home, and certainly, colonial expansion across the plains took a lot of effort. But there were some incidents where Canadians sort of considered doing these kinds of things. And so during the First World War, there was some effort, fairly serious, on the part of the Canadian Prime Minister, Robert Borden, to work out a deal with the British to acquire the Caribbean, the British West Indies. But as his advisors noted, this would probably mean that black people in the West Indies would want to move to Canada, and that would offend white Canadians who didn't want black neighbors. And so because of that issue, the government sort of backed away from that. So there were some instances where the Canadian government sort of considered some of these kinds of things. But I think, I don't know, Canadians, this is a huge overgeneration, but we don't like to spend money on things. Our militaries, we don't like to spend money. For a very brief period, we spent money on foreign aid, but we've been a laggard in that for many, many years. We tend to underfund our diplomatic corps and a whole series of other things. So, yeah, so that's a pretty typical Canadian thing, perhaps, is that the cost doesn't.
So it was frugality that kept us from expanding overseas.
I think so.
So just moving forward a little bit, the First World War is really interesting in Canadian history because the war began with, Canada's a dominion of Britain. And so the war began with a lot of Canadians really boosting for British patriotism. Not all Canadians, but a lot. But then with the war wrapping up, Canada then sought more autonomy. Can you explain how this happened?
Sure. I mean, when the war begins, Canada, again, is legally at war because the British Empire is at war. Now, Canada had a say over what it would do, right? It could have just stayed at, given maybe a few token troops or just focused on selling wheat and munitions and other kinds of things. And it did the latter, but it raised huge numbers of troops. One in 12 Canadians, I think that statistic is, served in uniform during the war, which, maybe in comparison to Britain or France wasn't a lot, but it's a significant for Canada. So, and that's because many Canadians, again, considered themselves British, and indeed the first contingent of Canadian soldiers who go over in late 1914, there's 31,000 of them in that first bunch, and I think 72% were recently arrived immigrants from Britain. So for them, it was no kind of thing, question that they would go and fight for Britain. But still, that didn't stop another 600,000 or so Canadians from volunteering to fight in this war. But I think one of the results of the war is to show just how empty the kind of jingoism was. And that's a typical kind of view, I think, that we have, many people have it. First War, and I think it's true today as it was that kind of understanding of the war in the 1920s and different kinds of things. And I think as a result, that many people think, well, what is the point of this link to the British Empire? Is it a boon or not? And if Britain is going to involve us in these kinds of things, are they trustworthy? And I think in Canada, there's a lot of flag waving about a battle that most people outside of the country have never heard of, called the Battle of Vimy Ridge, which takes place in 1917. And my students are always shocked when I tell them that most people outside of Canada have never heard of this battle, let alone think it's this kind of great moment. If you looked it up in most histories of the World War One, maybe there'll be an entry in the index and there may be a mention on a paragraph or something. But in Canada, it's this seen as this, at least for some Canadians, seen as this huge moment of sort of Canada coming as a nation. And there's a lot of myth-making about it and a lot of kind of propaganda about it. But I think, as I point out in the book, I think there's the myth of Vimy is true in some senses in that it really is a encapsulation of the view that I think many Canadians had, certainly even in government, that the cost of the British Empire could be or membership in the British Empire could be a very dangerous thing, and that as a result of the war, maybe Canada needs some more say over its own affairs, international affairs. And so there's a push then by the conservative pro-British government during the war and after for Canada to have more autonomous role. And the kind of impetus of the pressure behind that kind of dissipates a little bit, but it's only a few years later, 1926, that a Liberal Prime Minister, a fellow named William Lyon Mackenzie King, really pushes for this declaration of autonomy. And then again, under a Conservative government 5 years later, there's the passage, in Britain of something called the Statute of Westminster. But it's a conservative government in Canada at the time, a pro-British guy, R.B. Bennett. And so even conservatives and liberals, even despite their maybe pro-British feelings, push for Canada to be able to have a say in the world. And I think it's this idea that membership of the British Empire is good in theory, but in practice, maybe we can't trust the Brits to do well in things.
Mm-hmm. So the next sort of bit of your book deals with the interwar era. I really enjoyed this chapter. It detailed how Canadians were really on a widespread basis, really beginning to think about the world and, their relationship to the world. And so you have the rise of the first foreign affairs think tanks, the League of Nations Society, Model League of Nations Assemblies. Can you talk about this moment of internationalism and, what was driving it and what were the long-term consequences for Canada of this moment?
Sure. I think there's, a variety of threads in the interwar period. There's this kind of growing autonomy or push for autonomy from Britain. At the same time, there's plenty of pro-British boosters who still want to fight alongside, the British Lion when she roars. And so there's some incidents in the 1920s, something called the Chinat Crisis, which again is something that probably everyone, most people have forgotten, but it looked like Britain might go to war with Turkey and there were people calling for Canada to send troops. And so there's some pro-British boosters. There's these people who want more autonomy. And then there are people who begin to think, what is it about Canada and Canada's geography that really can distinguish us as a country? And they note that in a very famous phrase by a Canadian senator named Raoul Dandurand, who's a Canada's representative at a League of Nations assembly, he declares that Canada is a fireproof house far from flammable materials, because we have a very, at the time, and still a very friendly neighbor to ourselves, who, even though dwarfs us in economic terms, in military terms, in cultural terms, is not marching on our borders. We have three oceans around us otherwise, and so we don't have a lot to fear. And so there's many Canadians who argue in the 1920s, let's isolate ourselves. And again, we have this American thing too with isolationism, and obviously that's not 100% true, because America's evolving itself in the world in a whole series of other ways. But there's this argument that if we stay at home and tend our own garden, let the world sort itself out. We've paid enough in blood and treasure in the World War. Our country was ripped apart between English and French Canadians over a series of issues to do with conscription. And so let's let the world sort itself out and stay here and build ourselves up and profit from our good relations with our neighbor to the south. And so that's one of these sorts of strands. And then there's, of course, the other strand of people who say, and there's often overlap between some of these groups even, but there's, who say, well, this is a terrible war, and this new series of institutions have been built up to fix it, or to avoid such a situation in the future, the League of Nations most prominently. And so let's support these kinds of things. And so we have these kinds of strands, or these kinds of ideas begin to develop. And so there's these several sort of strands of thought going around in the 1920s in this kind of era, which is partly an era of hope and partly an era of great fear that bad things could happen again. And of course, we have a variety of kind of upheaval at home in terms of people who are inspired by the Russian Revolution and all series of things going on at the time. So there's some other kinds of fears going on as well. But I think this kind of themes of sort of good relations with the Americans, internationalism, isolationism, pro-British kind of feeling, autonomy, these are themes that will then play out in Canada over the next 2 years. And I should also say there's, of course, people who are very fearful of our relationship with the Americans. Because from most Canadians, certainly Anglophone Canadians, there's not much difference between us and the Americans on so many things. And the more they become our trading partners, the more we tune in to American radio stations, the more we read American magazines, see American films. Of course, most Canadian actors of any note go off and make their careers in the United States. The more American Canadians become, How Canadian are they? And that's a debate, of course, that Canadians have had for many, many, many years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll definitely talk more about the U.S.-Canada relationship. Just kind of staying on this note about internationalism, one story in your book that I was really interested in was the discussion of the Six Nations of Grand River Territory and their petitioning of the League of Nations to attain membership. Can you say something about this?
Well, sure. So the creation of the League of Nations, the Haudenosaunee Iroquois, for American listeners, petition essentially the League of Nations to allow representatives of their nation to sit at the League of Nations, arguing that, of course, they were an independent nation, and that as proof, in fact, they had, of course, made a series of treaties dating back to the 1600s with the Dutch and the French and the British, who'd recognized, you know, their sovereignty and independent rights and different things. And of course, the Canadians, well, not of course, but the Canadians were very worried by this and sort of teamed up with the British to ensure that the League of Nations wouldn't meet with these representatives and allow them to, of course, sit at the League of Nations, because it would, of course, be a threat to then Canadian sovereignty. And this will happen again in the 1960s and some other time. So at one time, of course, the Canadian government, or at this time, pardon me, the Canadian government is very keen to use the League of Nations to, in effect, get international recognition of Canada's autonomy from Britain. It's at the same time, of course, that the Canadian government is very worried about Indigenous people in Canada getting their sovereignty recognized by the League of Nations. And so it's this kind of dual track kind of approach to League of Nations that the Canadian government pursues, which I think is an interesting kind of aspect to this. Because again, the traditional kind of view is this focus on Canada's growing autonomy. But if we can complicate that a lot by looking at the role of Indigenous people in it, we get a slightly different sort of story.
Mm-hmm, totally. I mean, like what that episode reveals is that, there are a number of competing claims of sovereignty on, the same land. Canada is engaged in this internationalism. It's becoming more autonomous, but it's also containing other sovereignty or claims to sovereignty within its territory.
Yeah, and I might be jumping ahead a bit, but the same thing will happen in the 1960s, where the Canadian government toes a sort of a fine line between supporting calls of self-determination and supporting its NATO allies, most of whom have empires, but generally the Canadian perspective is to support the calls of self-determination movements, generally. At the same time, the Canadian government is extremely worried about the efforts of Quebec by this point to have a more international role, and it's certainly mindful of Indigenous peoples' growing demands for self-government and other sorts of things. And so that same dynamic will again play out sort of in the 1960s as well.
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about the growing autonomy of Canada. So sort of this long decolonization process from Britain. So Canada had been a self-governing dominion since 1867, but it took a surprisingly long time before Canada, got its independence. And so at one point you write that, after 1931, independence came in dribs and drabs, which I thought was a really evocative description of Canadian decolonization. And you also show how just like the formal attributes of sovereignty didn't arrive until very late. So for instance, like the Canadian flag that didn't include the Union Jack didn't appear until 1965. O Canada wasn't adopted as a national anthem until 1980. And, it wasn't until 1982 that Dominion Day was renamed Canada Day. So can you just say something for our listeners about Canada's slow decolonization?
Sure. So like Australia and New Zealand, the other, I guess, dominions, South Africa, I guess, too, but that's had a different sort of set of problems, I think. Many Canadians remain pro-British. I mean, even to today, you find pockets of pro-British people who watch Coronation Street avidly and care much too much, perhaps, about Prince George and all those people in Buckingham Palace. Although Americans do that too, which I think is fantastic. And so it's really the sort of 1950s and 1960s where I would say the kind of tide turns really against many Canadians identifying as pro-British. And that's part, I think, the changing immigration patterns. It's parting just Canada in some ways becoming more North American in terms of cultural habits and economic habits. And that's partly, I think, just enough time had begun to pass, you know, where those kinds of attitudes were dissipating. And so there is this process that Australian and New Zealand scholars have called de-dominionization, which isn't quite decolonization, because of course it's recognizing the fact that the dominions were a different sort of category. But arguing, you know, there's this change in habits, there's a change in attitudes, and there's a change in sort of legal statutes and other things to go along with kind of these changing cultural patterns. And so we see that in the creation in 1940. I'm going to out myself with being bad with dates, but 1949, with the creation of the Supreme Court of Canada as the final court of appeal. Okay. So the Supreme Court had been created in the 1880s, but essentially if you still wanted to appeal many cases, you could do so in Britain. And so in 1949, that's changed. There's a Citizenship Act in the 1946. It comes into effect in 1947, which actually creates a category called Canadian citizen. Before that, all Canadians have been British subjects. In 1953, again, I could be getting the date wrong on some the internet comment people will let me know. But the first Canadian-born Canadian becomes our Governor General. So there's a variety of kinds of steps, and this accelerates then in the 1960s. A whole series of ways that where Canada takes steps to become more independent, formally, right? And that culminates then in 1982 with the patriation of the Constitution, which until then had been an act of essentially the British Parliament, and then the Canadian Constitution becomes its own, in effect, Canadian document in 1982, which is not that long ago, really. So
this might be insider baseball to a lot of our listeners, but I really enjoyed the comment about Coronation Street in your book. You know, because like growing up, the CBC always carried Coronation Street. You know, my grandma watched it all the time. It was on daily. You know, you say that it's like this shouldn't be surprising given that you know, like nearly 500,000 Brits moved to Canada in the post-war, like the immediate decade after the Second World War. And so that was kind of like that would explain it moment.
Yeah, it's this, you know, the British economy was in the tank for a decade or so after the Second World War. So there's this kind of last gasp of sort of a huge immigration push by Brits after the Second World War. And there's still, of course, British immigration today, but it's nowhere near it was in this period. And so this is the, you know, these are my grandparents' neighbors and people like that. And you know, they played cricket. And I always thought that as a kid that was kind of weird. And they ate Marmite, which is inedible. And these people are still around.
Mm-hmm. That's sort of Canada's de-dominionization process.
Mm. I should say even up to the, you know, throughout and after the Second World War, the links between Canada and Britain were still strong. So I mean, we give a $2 billion loan. We actually kind of write it off to the British at the end of the war. I mean, that's a huge amount of money for Canada to have given. And when Canadian soldiers are deployed to NATO, they're deployed as part of the British Army on the Rhine. And when we deploy to the Korean War, we fight in a Commonwealth division. And so, you know, some of these links remained past the Second World War and into this kind of period as well.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so that's Canada's relationship to Britain. Canada also has a really interesting relationship to the U.S. And in fact, repeatedly in your book, you have these Canadians who are really anxious over just being inundated by, you know, like American culture and information and business. And so, you know, like in the 1920s and 30s, you show how American radio and magazines dominated the Canadian media landscape. And then again, in the 1950s, Hollywood and television, and then also just in terms of just like American ownership of Canadian business, which was quite high. Can you elaborate on this form of cultural imperialism and just how Canadians responded to it?
Sure. I mean, the Canada's border is obviously a figment of imagination, but it's also, of course, it's real. But this idea of the undefended border is a potent kind of symbol of the good relations between Canada and the United States, which I think have existed for quite a long time. But that doesn't mean that Canadians necessarily like their neighbors in many things. And of course, you and I will both know that a Canadian pastime is comparing ourselves generally in favorable ways to the United States. And yet at the same time, of course, Canadians are the largest consumers, I think, of American culture. We're the largest trading partner of the United States. Most Canadians live within 100 kilometers, was it 100 miles, out of the Canada's border. Hundreds of thousands of Canadians travel every year for their vacations to the United States. All of this is representative of a kind of very close relationship and a whole series of kind of things which we, I think, call transnational relations that have existed for a very long time between Canadians and Americans. And there's, you know, of course, Canadians who live part of the year as snowbirds in Florida, and there's huge pockets of people who've migrated to in New England, for instance. Lots of the French Canadians who went down in the early 20th century for work, and in, well, I think a magazine article, I think I cited it in the book, but certainly there was a magazine article, I think, in the Canadian version of Time in 1990 or something that noted that Los Angeles by population was the fifth or sixth largest Canadian city because there's so many at the time, but there's so many Canadians who work in Hollywood and other things. And so there's this incredible kind of interchange between Canadians and Americans. But what I find fascinating is the extent to which Canadians in the past and even today are really frightened about the kind of our links with the Americans. And I say this, you know, I suppose my personal bias and those sorts of things, but I grew up watching American TV and listening to American music, reading American authors. I did my PhD in American history. I read the, you know, Atlantic and Slate and all kinds of different things. But I don't necessarily feel any less Canadian, I think, doing those kinds of things. If anything, I think it makes me more Canadian, certainly today, in today's kind of, when you look at the United States today. But there's longstanding fear that the Canadians said that the more American things you consume or the more you trade with them, different kinds of things, the more American you become. And obviously, you know, as American Foreign Relations International historian, it's American cultural imperialism is a big field of study. And certainly it's true. There is American cultural imperialism in a whole series of ways. But at the same time, we can complicate that story, I think, because so often the people who are receiving the recipients, really, of American cultural imperialism are sometimes left out of the picture. Right? There's a big, you know, colonization often focuses on the people selling coke, you know, but not so much as on how people necessarily receive that. And so Canadians have been inundated for 150 years by the United States, and I don't think they're any less Canadian necessarily than they are today. At the same time, of course, we're no longer British. We're much more North American in our cultural habits. Car culture is prevalent here, you know, began in the 1920s as it did in the United States. And so there are some things that make us different. You know, most of our professional sports are the same sports Americans play. But maybe if we complicate the story, it's not that these things are American. Maybe they're North American, and that Canada, we should put ourselves in kind of North America, think of ourselves in more North American terms in terms of things we do. So that might be part of the push to my book too. And I think part of that is, of course, many Canadian, previous generations of Canadians viewed themselves as British, thought there was a kind of a zero-sum game between having a British kind of identity and an American kind of identity, and that the more American you became, the less British you might be. And that infected some of the politics and attitudes. But I, you know, maybe it's time to just think of ourselves as being more North American than anything else.
I mean, I think what your book reveals is just how like interesting of a case study Canada is for U.S. cultural imperialism, because like we are in so many ways similar to Americans. Like, we're probably more like the Americans than any other place in the world. And so it provides this like really unique context where like we're so similar, and so we're so anxious over, I don't know, like becoming more similar or something. Whereas like, you know, the cocoa colonization story in Europe is a little bit different, where, like France has a different history and tradition and culture and all that. And so the cultural imperialism plays out differently. Hmm.
And in some of those countries too, I mean, they have a much more, have culture with much longer roots than in Canada, right? And I think part of the Canadian story too is obviously it's a story of migrants coming to here, and what defines you as being Canadian. Well, for many Canadians, that used to be a British kind of heritage, and so many recent immigrants, whether they were of British sort of ancestry or not, became very, very pro-British in their views. And I think there's John Diefenbaker, who's our prime minister in the 50s and 60s, was German, but he's of German background. He was the most pro-British prime minister I think we've ever had, to kind of make up for that. And certainly my Ukrainian Baba loves the monarchy that more they think is healthy. but that was a way for her to fit in to a very Anglophone, Anglo-Saxon sort of society when she arrived here. So, and so I think defining what is a Canadian is this perennial problem in Canada, one of these perennial questions. And part of that is defining ourselves as being un-American. And that's a pastime that's as old as Canada, right? But at the same time, of course, as we both know, there's not actually that much. It is an important question, this issue of definition, because there's probably not that much that separates many Canadians from Americans.
Mm-hmm. So in addition to looking at the relationship between Canada and Britain, the relationship between Canada and the U.S., your book also historicizes several concepts that have guided Canadian foreign policy. And I think this is a really excellent sort of facet of your book. And one that is really fascinating to me, and just how persistent, like, or how it's persisted even to this day, is the idea of the middle power. Where did this concept come from, and why did Canadians latch onto it in the post-war era?
I think it's a concept that has two sort of understandings. One is it's a definition that comes out of the Second World War, when Canada wasn't a great power, certainly wasn't, to think ahead of the Cold War, wasn't a superpower, but we were not, I don't want to pick on Guatemala, but we weren't Guatemala necessarily. And so we were a different kind of sort of category. Not a minor power, we were a middle power. It's actually the Economist that in 1943 first uses this term to apply to Canada. We'd put a million men in uniform. We'd become an industrial powerhouse in terms of our industrial output. We'd, of course, ended the Great Depression and different sorts of things. We were, by the end of the war, thankfully untouched by physically by the damage. Canadian cities weren't bombed or anything. In a position of relative importance, which again is shocking, I think, to Canadian attitudes. And so we had some influence then, and it's important not to overemphasize how much, on the way in which the so-called liberal international order, which is another problematic maybe term perhaps, but was formed. And so Canadians were helped to sort of create some of the institutions. But it's important to think that, to note that Canadians were so cautious about doing this. It was a kind of a new idea that Canada would have a role to play in international affairs. And so some of those still sort of isolationist attitudes were still present at the time. And we also perhaps didn't have as much influence as some of the diplomats would note in their memoirs. But this idea that we had a role to play in the world comes out of this too. And that's the second sort of understanding of this idea of middle power, is not only did we have relative influence, but we should use that influence in the world. And so the other kind of way that people kind of conceptualize this idea of Canada as a middle power is that we get in the middle of problems in the international affairs. It's not only that we're, have a relative size and GDP to do things in national affairs, but that we should play a role in problems. And so that's really where the myth, perhaps in a pernicious kind of way, really plays out, because Canada is a middle power, a member of the G7. You know, we're a member of several alliances and different sorts of things. We have pretty high GDP. You know, we're not a great power, but we're a middle power, perhaps. But this idea that Canada has a role to play in the world, and a positive role to play, is also this kind of understanding of the middle power. And so it's this generation of kind of diplomats who arise in the late 1940s, early 1950s, who really portray Canada in this way. And to their credit, you know, they do have a role to play in negotiating things and taking on burdens through the UN for peacekeeping duties, let's say, or the role of the International Control Commission that monitors the sort of implementation of the Geneva Accords in Indochina. You know, Canada does take on certain international responsibilities that would have been anathema to previous generations of Canadian foreign policymakers. But the idea that Canada has always taken this kind of mediatory, very positive, benign role in the world is something that I think we should ask some questions about. And that's because, on the one hand, while we might have supported self-determination in some colonial contexts, we also were willing to sort of turn a blind eye to the fact that much of the equipment we were sending to our NATO allies wasn't being used for the defense of Europe, but was being sent to fight in Algeria or Indochina or other kinds of places. For example, or you know, we Canadian diplomats in the 1960s. Made some efforts to kind of through back channel kind of ways to see if there could be any room for negotiation between the Americans and the North Vietnamese. At the same time, we sold billions of dollars worth of military equipment to the Americans to use in Vietnam. And so it's a story about this kind of idea of middle power implies, I think, and it's still used today in the kind of rhetoric that some of the people in the Canadian government press are talking about Canada's efforts to become a member of the Security Council, that Canada has always played this kind of benign, helpful role in the world. And I think we can complicate that story a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's keep on talking about Canada's relationship with those like anti-colonial movements or those third world countries, because this was another sort of organizing theme of your book. And so so far you've explained how Canada was relating to the colonial powers, but can you say more about how it was relating to those anti-colonial movements or those third world countries?
Sure. Part of the view that I think used to be dominant in Canadian foreign policy history, and it's really changed maybe over the last 15 years, thanks to some groundbreaking work by people like David Webster, Ryan Toohey, Kevin Spooner, was that Canada had, in these kind of international crises or international situations, tried to take this kind of mediatory middle power role, not just between, say, communist powers and the West, but between colonial powers and sort of anti-colonial movements. And yet when you kind of get, when people have gotten in the archives, we see Canada maybe taking a pretty, often a dim view of anti-colonial sort of movements or the non-aligned movement that diplomats writing their memoirs perhaps didn't indicate. Mm-hmm. So, in a correct or not a correct, but an accurate or fulsome kind of manner. And so, for instance, an example is Canada's relationship with India, which was often seen to be a very productive relationship by two former British colonies, sort of seeking mapping out a way in which a Western country and an online country could sort of have productive relations. And certainly there were some efforts to work together, for instance, to bring an end to the Korean War. But the Canadian government was also very worried about the kind of things India was doing in terms of the non-aligned movement, in terms of bashing Canada's NATO allies, especially the British and French. And so the Suez Crisis, for instance, is this very storied moment in Canadian foreign policy history where our foreign minister, Lester Pearson, brokers a UN resolution to create a peacekeeping force to essentially go into the Suez Canal zone and bring an end to the fighting there. Because the reason why the French and British, the public reason why the British and French had intervened was to protect the Suez Canal zone from the fighting by the Israelis and Egyptians. And so what the Canadians essentially said was, well, let's actually put UN peacekeepers to do that task, and the British or French will be able to withdraw. And the reason the Canadians did that wasn't necessarily because of, you know, a happy belief in world peace or something. It was because the British and French had made a cock-up of this situation. And there were people like the Indians who were threatening to destroy, pull out of the Commonwealth, and put forward a series of resolutions condemning the British and French in very, very, very strong terms. And so what is often seen to be this kind of moment where Lester Pearson was standing up for peace is actually sort of Lester Pearson trying to help our allies who've got themselves in this terrible pickle. And so we actually viewed, you know, India in very negative terms, and actually during the Suez Crisis. And we were very flummoxed that they were so upset with British and French conduct in over Suez that they were ignoring the Soviets crushing the Hungarian Revolution. And so what's often seen to be a happy relationship between Canada and India is a bit more complicated than that. And similar kinds of things play out with Indonesia, for instance, and other countries at the time was the Third World. And so a sort of a happier story about Canada, this traditional view of kind of the middle power, and this Canada's a sort of benign actor or helpful actor in the world, can be a bit more complicated by getting into the archives and different sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just want to alert our readers to another thing that they can find in the book we won't really have time to talk about, but a lot of Canadians also saw their own de-dominionization process, decolonization process as a model that could be replicated elsewhere. And I thought that was a fascinating thread in the later sections of your book. Finishing up our conversation here, I began with a question about why international historians should care about Canada, but now I kind of want to ask something like an opposite question, which is, why is it important for Canadian historians, and indeed Canadians more generally, to understand how Canada has been a part of the wider world?
I think I don't know if I have to preach to Canadians necessarily this is the case. I think Canadians... many Canadians as recent immigrants, many more Canadians as only one or two generations in Canada, have an awareness of the fact of our ties abroad. I think many Canadians have an awareness that Canada is a country that where a huge portion of the economy is reliant on trading, especially natural resources, but trade abroad. I think there's been general, you know, the last few years saw tremendous support for Canada's continued membership of NAFTA after Mr. Trump threatened to destroy it. And what was so different from previous debates about free trade with the Americans in Canada is that very few Canadians of any political party, and certainly in the wider kind of populace, seem to be opposing the continuation of the Canada-US free trade agreement, whereas in 1988 it had been a 50-50 split. And so I think Canadians have an awareness that Canada is in many ways a global country, and that's a bit of claptrap about Canada being a global player. But many Canadians, I think, are aware that globalization has happened, and that for good or ill, Canada is going to be a terrible term, networked into the world abroad, whether through travel or migration or trade or other kinds of things. And certainly the rosy view that many Canadians have of their past, whether in foreign policy terms of peacekeeping and membership in NATO and support for the UN, these are not controversial subjects necessarily, because many Canadians, I think, have a view that Canada has a role to play in these alliances. And an interesting aspect of Mr. Trump and his NATO bashing has just been to see that most Canadians have defended NATO, at least in some way, or at least not spoken out against NATO, continued NATO membership, or asked, what's the point of being a part of this organization? So I think that's an interesting aspect, is that Canadians in many ways are a global country. And again, that kind of sounds like misty-eyed claptrap or something, but I think it's very true in a whole lot of ways.
Great. Okay, so that concludes our conversation. Go on, sorry.
I was just going to say, and so the idea of telling Canadians that international history or that their understanding, you know, their place in the world from a historical perspective is important, I think, is something that many Canadians might accept as already accept, mm-hmm. whether they realize it or not.
And so, yeah, that concludes our conversation about the book. But we always finish off our podcasts with the question, what you're working on right now?
I've got a book on Canadian-Cuban relations from 1959 onwards. Looking at sort of diplomatic relations, at sort of national security kinds of things, and also tourism as an aspect of Canadian international history, and a whole series of activists and other kinds of people who were inspired by the Cuban Revolution or went to Cuba and took messages about the Cuban Revolution back to Canada. So it's looking at a rich history of Canada-Cuba relations beyond maybe just focusing on the embargo or something like that. So that's what I'm finishing that, and I'm also writing with two other colleagues, a sort of history of Canadian-American relations in the 50s, which is weirdly an overlooked topic, I think, because the relationship is generally productive and people like to focus on flashpoints and crises. Anyway. So.
Wonderful. Well, I will be looking forward to both of those. Aza, I really want to thank you again for coming onto the program.
Well, thank you for having me, Dexter.
Absolutely. And we've been talking about Canada and the World since 1867, Aza McKercher's latest book, and you've been listening to New Books in History.